Justice Zinner has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Gene Paul Keene, judge from the Second Judicial Circuit, to sit in his place for this first case. The court would also like to welcome students from Menno High School, Brandon Valley High School, Baltic High School, Bone Steel Fairfax High School, Sioux Falls Christian High School, and Wagner High School. These are the schools that were scheduled to attend today. We understand there may be a few that have come that I'm not aware of that were originally scheduled yesterday and could not make it because of the weather. But welcome to all of you. The first case for oral argument this morning is in the matter of Stephen J. Tinklenberg, appellant. For the appellant, Tinklenberg, we have Ms. Patricia DeHewick, an attorney from Pierre, and Mr. Shannon Rigsby, an attorney from Sioux Falls. My understanding is, Mr. Rigsby, you will speak for 7 minutes, and then Ms. DeHewick for 13. And then on rebuttal, it will be Mr. Rigsby for 3 minutes and Ms. DeHewick for 7. Is that correct? Okay. For the appellee, which is the Division of Insurance, State of South Dakota, is Mr. Neil Fulton, an attorney from Pierre. With that, Mr. Rigsby, you may proceed, and you have 7 minutes, sir.
Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court. As stated by Justice Gilbertson, my name is Shannon Rigsby, and I, with Patricia DeHewick, represent the appellant and licensee in this case, Stephen J. Tinklenberg. We have decided to split the issues that we will address. I will address the motion to dismiss. Ms. DeHewick will address the merits of the case, as well as the ex parte communications which occurred in the proceedings before this one. First thing I would like to do, though, Your Honors, is I would like to correct an error in our brief. In our brief, we listed the standard of error incorrectly. The standard of error for this court is clearly erroneous, as opposed to what we had listed in our brief, which was a review under 126.36. That would be the circuit court's standard of review, and we concede that error in our brief. With the court's permission, however, I would ask to forego a detailed fact analysis prior to speaking. I believe that would be more relevant to the merits of the case, and I believe Mr. DeHewick has one there. I would like to address, however, the facts that are important to my argument on the motion to dismiss, which is the timeline, in that the summer of 2000, the Division of Insurance received a complaint alleging wrongdoings by Stephen J. Tinklenberg. In the summer of 2001, the South Dakota State Legislature removed the authority for the Division of Insurance to act administratively on the alleged wrongdoings of Mr. Tinklenberg. And on January 18th, 2002, excuse me, 6.5 months after the repeal and 8 years after the date of the alleged wrongdoing, the Division of Insurance finally commenced their case. The complaint that was filed against Mr. Tinklenberg at that time had 4 counts, which was later reduced to 3. They were under 5830-106, Title 5830 being the insurance code, which I'll refer to at this point as the old law to avoid a lot of confusion on numbers. 5830-167, which was a new law, and 5830-157, which addressed address changes and the requirement that Mr. Tinklenberg notify the division within 30 days of a move.
So part of it was under the old law, part of it was under the new law?
Yes, Justice Meyer Henry. The original complaints, and actually the subsequent complaints after that, and despite repeated questions from Judge Atkinson, who was the initial hearing examiner, as to which one are you going to charge him under, the Division of Insurance attempted to charge him for violations under 106 and 167, despite their own argument that both those laws were one and the same.
Well, what happened then to the charges under the new law? Were those all then dismissed?
Well, under Judge Atkinson, she looked at the motion to dismiss, which was brought under by Mr. Tinklenberg up to that point, and dismissed, recommended that all charges be dismissed. It was then sent to the agency, which reversed her decision. We appealed, did an intermediate appeal, all the way up to this very court, and it was sent back for a hearing on the merits. After hearing on the merits, Your Honor, it went to the circuit court directly below this court. The judge in that circuit court agreed that 167 was a new law because it had no retroactive language, contained no special savings clause, and expressed no intent by the legislature to be a reenactment of old 106, and therefore did not apply. However, 106 was decided by the circuit court to apply because the circuit court felt that the general savings clause listed under 214.18 applied to resurrect section 106. Now, as I've mentioned, the old law was section 106 was repealed expressly by the legislature. The new law did not apply because it was not in existence at the time of the alleged wrongdoings. And the address change violation, which would be section 157, was unsupported by details despite constant applications by Mr. Tinklenberg for further detail. Under section 12617, which is the statute which controls proper notice in these matters, it states that there upon application a more definitive and detailed statement shall be furnished. However, in this case, and Judge Atkinson agreed, that no detail was furnished until the morning of October 16, 2003. That's 1 year, 8 months, and 28 days after the initial complaint and after several repeated applications for further detail. The circuit court directly below this did not address that portion of the motion to dismiss, although it is part of the record and was addressed in our brief up to this point. Judge Atkinson, as I mentioned, dismissed the case.
2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. The error that we would argue that the circuit court below made is by stating that the general savings clause applies to this case. In that decision, the circuit court decided that a penalty, a revocation of an insurance licensee's license, is a penalty within the contemplation of the general savings clause. This is incorrect. The case used to support the circuit court's decision was Kent v. Lyons, which was a case that had nothing to do with any sort of application of the general savings clause. Contrary to that, in two cases that we have cited, State Highway Commission versus Wazorik and Schultz v. Gibbon, this court has decided that the definition of the word penalty, liability, and forfeiture under the general savings clause applies only to criminal matters, tax matters, creditors' rights, liens, performance bonds, and forfeitures, not revocation. It's been quite clear on that. And even if this court were to expand that definition today, the general savings clause would still not resurrect 106 because it speaks to sustain cases, causes of actions for penalties, liabilities, and forfeitures incurred. There was no action to sustain at the repeal of 106 because nothing had been commenced yet. And no penalty had been incurred because absent an assumption of guilt before proof of innocence, you cannot state that a penalty has been incurred until a full and final decision on the merits.
Have we had any cases that actually define sustaining as it applied to that statute?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor, but as the Division of Insurance has argued also in their brief, in statutory construction, otherwise, if it has not been directly defined, you would use the plain language of the word. Sustain means to continue. There was no action commenced to continue.
Judge Keene, do you have a question? Your time has expired, Mr. Rigsby.
Thank you.
Ms. DeHuick, you have 13 minutes.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Patricia DeHuick on behalf of licensee Tinklenberg. In light of the fact that we have limited time this morning, Your Honors, to explain fully the facts of this case and the statement of the case, I would like to at least condense it, put it into a nutshell for purposes of the oral argument. Albert and Mary Klein were brother and sister, and they lived on a farm in Cottington County, right outside of Watertown. In 1980, Stephen Tinklenberg, who was a licensed insurance agent in Sioux Falls, and at that time working for Penn Life Corporation, he was working for Penn Life Corporation, and he sold Albert Klein a $25,000 life insurance policy. At that time, back in the 1980s, It was Penn Life Corporation's policy to encourage their insurance agents, when selling insurance policies, to recommend to the insured that the insured name someone other than himself as the owner of the policy, and that was done solely for tax purposes at the time. Subsequently, the IRS had changed those tax requirements, and so that no longer was the policy. So anyway, Tinklenburg did this when he sold the policy to Albert, and Albert decided to name his sister Mary as the owner of the policy. He paid the initial premium, but 1 year later, he was deemed to be physically disabled for waiver of premiums. So thereafter, he didn't pay any premiums on that policy.
Did his condition change any in that 1 year?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Did his condition change any in that 1 year, or was he disabled at the time the policy was sold to him?
I don't know if that's in the record, Your Honor. He was at some point confined to a wheelchair. He had difficulty with his knees, but I'm not sure when that occurred. I just know that at some point when the premium came up, Penn Core Life concluded that he met the definition of physically disabled.
Wasn't he also mentally challenged?
There is evidence in the record that he was.
And his sister took care of him, isn't that right? And he lived with his sister all of his life.
He lived with his sister all of his life.
And she was his caretaker.
Well, I don't know if she was his caretaker. I don't know if the record really established that she was his caretaker. I know the record does establish that Albert Klein took care of his own business affairs.
Is this situation any different than cases we've had before where a lawyer writes a will for a client and the lawyer winds up being the beneficiary in the will?
Well, I think it probably is a little different in that lawyers are not supposed to be doing that. It would be considered unethical, I believe, for a lawyer to name himself as a beneficiary in a will. I don't believe that same standard of care applies to an insurance agent. And just as a footnote, I think it's interesting to know that just this year, albeit it's not in the record, but the South Dakota legislature killed a bill that had been pro-offered by the Division of Insurance that would specifically prohibit an insurance agent from being named as the beneficiary in an insurance policy that he sold.
Certainly it wasn't the policy. You mentioned Penn Life's policy. They didn't have any policy that encouraged their agents to sell insurance so that they could be, the agents could end up being the beneficiaries.
I'm sure they did not have such a policy.
Did they have a policy against it?
I don't know. That is not in the record, to my knowledge.
What insurable interest does Mr. Tinklenburg have in the policy? He's not a charity. He's not related to him.
We would concede that Mr. Tinklenburg had no insurable interest in the policy.
Then why did he
And
take,
even the lower court found
Why did he
such.
Accept the policy?
It was given as a gift to him, and it was given as a gift because over the intervening years from 1980 up until the death of Albert Klein, Tinklenburg continually helped the Kleins. He took hundreds of phone calls, and the record is very well established in this regard, in the extent to which Mr. Tinklenburg went out of his way to help Albert and Mary Klein at for no remuneration at all.
Then why, when Albert died and the people who thought they were beneficiaries under the policy, when they called him and asked him, why didn't he just say there was a gift? Why did he keep this duplicitous attitude that I'm not going to tell anybody?
Because he had a policy, and in his office they had a policy that it was not appropriate for insurance producers to disclose information to anybody other than the insured. And so he didn't feel as if he could disclose that information.
Is it in the record that this man who gave him this gift not only was disabled, but that he suffered from schizophrenia and had intellectual impairments?
There was testimony to that effect where Albert Klein, years earlier, had been admitted to, at that time, now it's called the Human Services Center, I'm not sure what it was called at that point in time, and that he had been evaluated by a mental health professional, and that there was some concern that he was mentally challenged. We would submit, Your Honor, that the record also is replete with evidence to establish that Albert was pretty sharp. He took care of all of his business affairs until much later in 1999, when his niece, Marianne Brennan, was named conservator of his matters.
Well, but I thought he couldn't even dress himself.
I don't believe that's in the record, Your Honor.
I thought his sister had to take care of that everyday needs for him.
I would submit that's not an accurate reflection of the evidence presented in the record.
All right.
But there is some evidence in the record on that point. It depends upon who the hearing officer believed, isn't that right?
That's correct.
Okay,
and later on, we would submit and we argue to the lower court that the hearing examiner's findings of fact are not based on the evidence in the record, and that they are clearly erroneous, taken in light of all of the testimony and documentary evidence presented in this matter.
But in response to the Chief Justice's question, it's not as if there's only testimony on the point that favors you. There's conflicting testimony that the hearing officer had to make a choice or decision on, isn't that
That's
right?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. In 1993, Albert told Tinklenburg on one of the visits to Albert's farm that he wanted Tinklenburg to have the policy. And presumably that was his way of thanking Tinklenburg for all of the many things that he had done for both Albert and Mary over this period of time. So Tinklenburg obtained the proper transfer form from Penn Life, took it out to the farm, sat down to the kitchen table with Mary and Albert, which he had done countless times, explained the transfer form, and Albert told his sister, Mary, to sign it, which she did.
Did Mr. Tinklenburg recommend to Albert that he get independent advice from a neutral third party before this transfer was made?
Your Honor, that's not in the record, but I believe that he did not.
All right.
Then after Albert's death in 1999, Marianne Brennan filed a complaint against Mr. Tinklenburg with the Division of Insurance, and that's where we are today. I would like to address the ex parte issue at this time, Your Honors. On appeal from the administrative proceeding to the lower court, Tinklenburg filed a motion for the taking of additional testimony and evidence. He did this once he learned that the draft decision of the hearing examiner had been circulated among the state agencies 10 days prior to him receiving a signed copy of the decision. He also knew that the general counsel for the Division of Insurance had been involved in his investigation and also consulted with, advised, and drafted the decision for ultimately the final decision maker, Wendell Molson.
Isn't that his job?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that the job of that person?
The general counsel?
Yeah.
Well, we would argue that the general counsel has one set of a particular set of duties, but it would be inappropriate for the general counsel, who also is involved in the investigative stage and the prosecution stage, to then ultimately advise and consult with the final decision maker.
But he didn't make the final decision, did he?
Wendell Molson did make the final decision.
But we're talking about the legal counsel. You jumped one level above him. We're talking about Mr. Molson. That's the general legal counsel.
No, Molson was the acting director of the division.
Yeah. Who's different than the legal counsel?
Legal counsel was Naomi Cromwell.
Right. And just so there's no, so everybody understands this, Ms. Atkinson, she got out of the job eventually. But when she was there, she made a decision. She agreed with the fact that she thought the most recent statute superseded the old one, and they couldn't bring any charges.
Correct.
There was a disagreement in the agency about that, and then they sort of removed her from being the hearing officer and brought somebody else in. So is something wrong with that?
Well, they didn't agree with her decision to grant the motion to dismiss.
Right. And, of course, that's something the agency could do.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And then, yes, another hearing examiner was brought in because Atkinson was removed.
2 minutes.
Oh, my gosh. Well, the lower court granted our motion, took additional evidence. Tinklenburg called in 5 witnesses that all worked for the state, and it was interesting to note that in examination of those witnesses, all admitted that they knew about the case, they had heard about it, and they had discussions, but amazingly, nobody had any clear recollection of the specificity of those discussions, when the meetings occurred, or whether or not emails were distributed. Except that the record does establish, our position is the record does establish that Naomi Cromwell was involved in the investigation of the case, in the prosecution of the case, and in advising Wendell Malsom, the acting director of the division. She was involved in the decision to refer the case to the division's fraud unit, and she even had a phone conversation along with Sherry Devers, the state's investigator, and visited with Mr. Tinklenburg about whether or not he would voluntarily issue up his license. The record also establishes that the decision maker, Wendell Malsom, in fact testified at the hearing that he may have heard the Tinklenburg matter being discussed. And he further testified that our division is so small, you're going to hear what is going on. Tinklenburg would submit that this testimony alone establishes at the very least indirect communication. And the point we are trying to make, Your Honors, is that there was indirect communication in violation of 126.26. The lower court essentially said that's okay because also contained in 126.26 are two provisions that allow the decision maker to enlist the aid of other members of the agency and to have personal assistance. Our point is, how can you have a restriction on ex parte communication when within the same statute you're allowed to talk to anybody in the agency regarding the matter?
Your time has expired,
thank
Mr.
you.
Hewick. Thank you. Mr. Fulton, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. I think that two issues are critical to focus on at the outset. One of them is the standard of review, particularly as it would relate to the factual findings, because so much of this case turned on credibility findings made below. And as the court well knows, the standard of review is clearly erroneous, particularly when we're talking about witness credibility. The trial court level is the exclusive judge of the credibility of witnesses, and live witnesses in particular. One area that I would highlight is that the hearing examiner, Julie Johnson, the only person to hear Mr. Tinklenburg testify live, specifically rejected his testimony and his credibility in her findings of fact. The second area that I think is critical to focus on at the outset is that there are two reasons that Mr. Tinklenburg's license was revoked. First, there is the issue involving transfer of the policy, fraud involving the transfer of the policy, the conversion of the policy to his own use. There is also, secondarily, the address issue. Mr. Tinklenburg's failure to notify the Division of Insurance of a change of residence address within 30 days as statute required. That secondary issue is not involved in the repeal and reenactment and savings clause issue. So it's important to remember at the outset that that issue does not need to be resolved to affirm the lower court's decision, because the court can affirm on any basis.
Are you suggesting his license should be revoked because he didn't tell them of a change of address?
I am suggesting that it can, Chief Justice Gilbertson, because the statute provides that it can be done. I mean, that was a policy decision made by the legislature, and they direct the Division of Insurance that insurance agents in a highly regulated industry have to keep people told where they are, where they can get in contact with. So, yes, the statute does provide that they can revoke for that basis alone.
I want to ask a question about the two different, the new law and the old law. If the agency brought this action under the new law, would it have not applied to this action? I mean, would you not have been able to revoke his license under the new law as opposed to the old law? Is that why the old law was used?
Oh, absolutely. You could revoke under either one, Justice Meyer Henry.
Okay, then why wasn't the new law used instead of that?
The old and the new law were cited in the notices of hearing. I didn't handle the matter at the administrative level. I don't know why they cited each particular one, but I think they cited both for that very reason. They are substantively the same, and I think that goes to the heart of the repeal and reenactment issue is you look at not was there a verbatim reenactment, but you look at was the same conduct prescribed under both the old law and the new law. If so, there is a repeal and reenactment such that the law continues in force right along. So you look here at what was in the old law and what was in the new law. The old law talks about violation of or noncompliance with an applicable provision of this title. The new law talks about violating any insurance laws or rules, subpoena. It's the same conduct, just phrased slightly differently. You go on then to misappropriation or conversion to his own use or illegal withholding. In the new law, that's withholding, misappropriating, or converting any monies. When Mr. Tinklenburg acted to convert the policy to his own use, to make the owner and beneficiary no longer Mary Klein and the Klein siblings, but rather himself, he converted that property. It was prescribed by both the old and the new law.
Was there ever a gap, or was it one day we had old law, next day we had new law?
There was no gap, Chief Justice Gilbertson. Both were addressed in the, it would be the 2001 legislative session. They were separate bills. One repealed the old law, and then there was a new law that was more of an omnibus bill that put it back in place. So on June 30 of 2001, the old law is in place at midnight. The new law took effect, so there was no gap in coverage, which makes it different from some of the cases we've cited in our brief. Particularly, there's the Weislander case that's an Iowa DUI case in which the Iowa Supreme Court was dealing with a DUI statute. In that case, there was a two-year gap. Someone was trying to apply for a license reinstatement, and the statute had a two-year gap in coverage. And the Supreme Court rightly said there's no repeal and reenactment that allows continuous coverage because it was gone for 2 years. Our scenario was different.
Did Julie Johnson's credibility determinations go to the explanation that Mr. Tinklenburg gave as to his change of address?
They did, Justice Sabres, they did, because he testified about that issue, and there was testimony taken from Division of Insurance personnel, particularly Tiffany Clear, who is the person who is at the desk that receives those phone calls, faxes, and emails. Ms. Clear testified that she has a computer mainframe, and if Neil Fulton is an insurance agent, he can send a fax, he can send a letter, he can send an email, he can make a phone call and say, I'm moving from 417 North Huron and Pier to Miller. I'm going to move back home to my hometown. That's enough. But Ms. Clear testified that she did not have a record of a phone call. She did not have an entry in the mainframe showing there was a change. She didn't have any paper record that Mr. Tinklenburg had said.
But did Julie Johnson make a finding that she believed her and did not believe Tinklenburg in relation to his explanation?
She specifically found that she did not find Tinklenburg credible. I don't remember if she specifically said, I find Tiffany Clear credible, but she did say that Mr. Tinklenburg had not given notice of the change of address within 30 days. So, yes, she resolved the facts in favor of the division employee, and she specifically found that she rejected Mr. Tinklenburg's testimony in total.
And you think that's enough to revoke a license in and of itself?
It is under the statutory scheme. And I think that this court's role on this is not to pass on whether that's a good idea or not. That's the legislature's role. And reasonable people can certainly disagree on how they resolve some of those questions. I'd agree with that. But they have delegated that authority to the Division of Insurance to say, these people, because insurance is a highly regulated industry, this is enough. You've got to keep us posted on where you are within 30 days. I don't think we ultimately have to rely just on that, because I think we have the repeal and reenactment, and we also have the general savings clause. So I think while we can rely solely on that, we don't need to in this particular instance.
Now, the lower court relied upon the savings statute, didn't it?
The administrative hearing officer relied on the repeal and reenactment, and the and the circuit court found that it was the general savings clause. Judge Gores rejected the conclusion that there was a repeal and reenactment.
Okay, so you're probably what I'm hearing you saying is that the administrative law judge probably was more accurate.
Yes, I would say that they both reached the correct result, but I would say that Ms. Johnson was more accurate in her approach to the repeal and reenactment issue.
And if we held that way, we wouldn't even have to get to the savings clause issue.
That is correct. That is correct. Yeah, you can resolve it just by looking at the repeal and reenactment. One question was raised about whether this is similar to a lawyer writing themselves as a beneficiary of a will, and I think that's a very apt analogy for a lot of reasons. The first is there was testimony that this was simply unethical for an insurance agent to do. Catherine Clear, who testified and when was a Penn Life representative, said, in her opinion, this would be unethical. It is unethical for an agent who wrote the business to then turn around and ask people, the owner, Mary Klein, to transfer the policy to him or her, period. Regardless of whether there was full explanation, regardless of whether there was a reference out to independent counsel, the simple act of taking the business yourself would be unethical. I think then you go on to the fact that there was testimony that was accepted by the hearing officer that Mr. Tinklenberg ultimately abused his position of trust with the Klein family. There was testimony in the record by Mary Ann Brennan, Mr. Klein's niece, that Mary Klein had to help him get dressed. There was testimony in the record that Mr. Klein had a borderline functioning IQ. There was testimony in the record from Dr. Robert Burry, who had treated him, that he had been diagnosed with schizophrenia. There was testimony in the record by Mary Klein in her criminal trial testimony that Albert needed her help just to get through his daily activities. So into that situation comes Mr. Tinklenberg. Mr. Tinklenberg has the policy transferred by Mary Klein, its owner. And that's critical to remember. Mary Klein was the owner. Albert Klein had no ownership of the policy, and he had no ability to transfer the policy. Mary Klein owned the policy, and only she could transfer it.
Well, she signed off some papers that transferred it to him.
She signed off on some papers, and she testified, Justice Sabers, that she didn't understand the papers, that they were not explained to her, and that she never would have knowingly transferred ownership of the policy. More critical, I think, even remember, is Sherry Deaver's testimony, which was accepted by the lower court and the hearing officer, that Mr. Tinklenberg, in her initial interviews with him, told her that he didn't explain the policy, that he had Mary Klein sign a blank transfer form, and that he did not take the time to answer questions or explain the effect of these. Now, I grant that Mr. Tinklenberg then testified to a very different story. But Ms. Deaver testified in front of the hearing officer, who had the opportunity to observe her and make a determination about her credibility, determined that Ms. Deaver was credible and that Mr. Tinklenberg had told her those things. So we have it ultimately from Mr. Tinklenberg's own mouth that he didn't explain this.
What significance, if any, do you give to the fact that Mr. Tinklenberg paid for Albert's funeral out of the insurance proceeds?
I think, Your Honor, that a repentant sinner is ultimately still a sinner. The fact that he paid some of the money isn't good enough. All of that money ultimately belonged to the Klein family. I would say that it's certainly reasonable for the lower court to resolve that by saying, well, that's a good effort to cover your tracks, because suddenly, you know, that money was supposed to go to the funeral expenses. If you pay that out, maybe they don't notice. So I think the simple fact that he did something good in the course of a bad act doesn't redeem the entire course of bad acts. And I think that the hearing examiner resolved that against him.
I have a question on this ex-party communication. Can you address that from the agency side? Because obviously for people to come before an agency of the government, they want to get a fair shot at it. And if there's ex-party communication going on that such as being alleged here, there's a problem. Can you address why that didn't take place here, or why you think we should overlook this?
I can, Justice Myron Henry. That, again, was testimony in front of Judge Gores. And it was addressed by all the people involved in the process. Wendell Malsom, who's the acting director. Mr. Malsom testified, and I'm going to consult my notes here a little bit, that he had no conversations with the investigators. That Gary Steich, who was at that point the director of the Division of Insurance, said, you're going to sit on this case as the final decision maker. Wendell Malsom said he didn't know why that was. He was just told that was what he would do. He resolved the case by consulting Julie Johnson's findings and conclusions and reviewing, he said, a couple of boxes of record materials. He said with specificity that he never had contact with Randy Moses, Sherry Deaver, or the investigatory representatives of the Division of Insurance about the facts of the case. Next person I think it's important to focus on is Naomi Cromwell, who is the general legal counsel to the Division of Insurance. Ms. Cromwell was initially involved in some of the work regarding the investigation. She testified, however, that the decision on whether to move forward with the administrative proceeding to revoke Mr. Tinklenberg's license would have been made by the staff counsel actually handling the case, Cindy Koppel and Sarah Harms. She, on the initial motion to dismiss, served as legal advisor to the final decision maker, Mr. Malsom. She then, when the matter moved forward on the revocation itself, recused herself and had Jack McGee step in, and she testified that I felt at that point it would be inappropriate for me to advise any of them. But she and Mr. Malsom both testified that they never had a discussion about the substance of the case, about the facts of the case, that her only consultation with Mr. Malsom was to advise him on the law as it applied to the motion to dismiss issue. So there was separation as to the findings of fact. And there is, in the statute, authorization for Mr. Malsom to have legal counsel from within the division. But the crucial thing is, do you foul the well? Is there poisoning of the well? And there wasn't here, because no one had contact with Mr. Malsom about the facts of the case other than through the findings and conclusions rendered by Julie Johnson. And I think that's a huge thing to look at here to remember on this ex parte communication issue. The ultimate findings and conclusions were made not by Wendell Malsom or anyone at DOI, they were made by Julie Johnson at the Office of Hearing Examiners. So you have a totally separate person, and that's the function of OHE. Totally separate person, hears the evidence, reviews it, makes her written decision, and then it comes to Mr. Malsom, whose job is to thumbs up or thumbs down based on reviewing the record. So I think here you've even got another level of separation that assuages those concerns about ex parte contact. And you have all the testimony of the DOI folks who said we didn't have contact about the substance of this, and no contradictory testimony by Mr. Tinklenberg. So I think that issue ultimately is not problematic and was appropriately resolved by the circuit court. I would like to spend just one more minute on the repeal and reenactment and the general savings clause issues, if I can. Starting with the savings clause issue, it's been suggested that a penalty does not apply in this case, that revocation of Mr. Tinklenberg's license was not ultimately a, quote, penalty for purposes of the savings clause. And I think that's incorrect for a couple of reasons. First is, as the court well knows, we apply plain ordinary meaning to words and statutes and give them their full effect. A penalty, if you look at the sources cited in our brief, is ultimately a prescribed punishment, a prescribed sanction for a particular conduct. In this case, I think revocation of a professional license is pretty clearly a penalty. It's something that people try and avoid. A penalty isn't necessarily just a term of imprisonment or a monetary fine. It is some sanction that you impose on someone for doing something wrong. When I was a child and I had my toys taken away, that was certainly a penalty. When I didn't get to go to the basketball game, that was certainly a penalty. So I think in this case, when you take someone's license away for violating the rules applicable to insurance agents, that's a penalty. The second thing is the court has already addressed this in the Kent v. Lyon case. And I think we have two competing cases with that Wazorek and Talbot case and this Kent case. And Kent, I think, is the controlling authority here because the court in that setting was talking in the specific context of an insurance license revocation proceeding, and they described it as a penalty. The Wazorek
action, had that been started, though? Was it in the works before the before the law was repealed in Kent?
I don't know the answer to that, Justice Meyer Henderby.
But because that, I want to draw your attention to the word sustaining. That's the word that bothers me in that statute. It almost, to me, that indicates something's already in the works and it can be sustained as opposed to started.
I agree with the fact that sustaining is a critical word on this thing, but I think if you look at the full text of the statute, what it talks about is the effect of the repeal. And it says the repeal of any statute shall not have the effect to release or extinguish any penalty, and that such statute shall be treated as still remaining in force for the purpose of sustaining any proper action or prosecution. So what I think it does is it says that if you violate a statute that provides for a penalty and that statute then is repealed, it is not King's X as to your conduct that was inappropriate at the time. That the general savings clause freezes that for those people who violated it during the period of time.
You have about a minute and a half.
The example I would use is last year's criminal code revision bill. Let's interject into that, into Senate Bill 44, a provision dealing with jaywalking. Let's say the existing or old law said it is not legal for any person to cross the street at any place other than a marked intersection, and if so, he shall be subject to a penalty of a Class 2 misdemeanor. Let's say that during that entire process, you have additional language put in that takes that off the books. I think that if I was jaywalking on June 30th when that was still in the books, I'm subject to the sanction that was in place for that. And I think if the court looks at Sutherland on statutory interpretation at section 23:37, there is some support for that approach, that what it does is freeze the conduct and the penalties that were in place for people at that time. But again, the court does not need to reach the general savings clause issue because we feel that the repeal and reenactment just had the law carry on straight through with the same conduct being prescribed for Mr. Tinklenberg. The court has no further questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fulton. Okay. Mr. Rigsby, you have 3 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, my part in this is to address the motion to dismiss, and so I'd like to rebut a few of the comments made by the Division of Insurance on the repeal and reenactment. The law in this state is clear. To repeal and reenact a statute, the intent of the legislature has to be clear and manifest, and the language has to be identical or practically identical. That's a statement from State v. Reynolds. The language in 167 is nowhere near identical or practically identical. In State v. Reynolds, the court held that it was a reenactment because only one word had been changed in two places. In the 167, we had, to quote from our brief on page 1, there are worlds apart as far as, page 3, it contained, 106 contained notice and hearing rights, limitations on suspensions, and limited the director to revocation or refusal of new licenses, whereas 167 includes the power to refuse to initially issue a license. It no longer contains hearing and notice provisions whatsoever and has removed the limitation on suspensions. There are differences in verb tenses. The preamble was completely overhauled. This is not an identical or practically identical statute. And the state law in this state is clear as to what the standard is.
Mr. Rigsby, when was the Reynolds case decided?
The Reynolds case, I believe, was decided in 1931, Your Honor.
When was the savings clause adopted by the state legislature?
That I'm not aware of, Your Honor, but I know that in cases...
It was 1939.
Okay.
So they had the case in mind when they passed the statute. So weren't they trying to cover the Reynolds case?
The general savings clause itself, Your Honor, was not addressed in the Reynolds case. It was simply the repeal and reenactment. I believe that there is no case law on the books that repeal or overturn State v. Reynolds as far as what it says to a repeal and reenactment. If you want to apply the general savings clause, that applies to to statutes that are expressly repealed, not inferredly repealed or impliedly repealed, like those would be required for a repeal and reenactment. And 106 was expressly repealed. That's why only the general savings clause can save it. And in this state, penalty has been specifically defined. Had it not been specifically defined in Wazorik and Schultz v. Gibbon, Your Honor, I would agree possibly that Division of Insurance is correct that the word penalty would be given its plain language meaning and revocation would fit under that. But this court has been very careful to limit it only to those matters which I stated earlier. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rigsby. Ms. DeHuick, you have 7 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to address a couple of the issues that Mr. Fulton raised. To begin with, this change of address issue, Tinklenburg would submit that the department clearly failed to provide, by clear and convincing evidence, that he failed to provide them with his change of address. If you look at the record, you will see that Tiffany Carr, whom Mr. Fulton kept referring to, wasn't even employed by the division in 2001 when supposedly all of this occurred. She simply occupied that position at the time of the hearing and was called to testify as to the procedures employed by the agency when taking change of address calls or emails or whatever from insurance agents. The only
And her testimony was just that. There
normal
was no
procedure.
There was no record of it as far as an email was concerned, as far as the fax was concerned, or any other record as of that time.
Her testimony was to describe the normal course of action that is taken by employees in the division when they receive change of address forms, either through an email or a fax or a telephone. Tinklenburg, on the other hand, could provide documentary evidence of a telephone record that established that he, in fact, did call the Division of Insurance in June of 2001, and the phone call lasted a couple of minutes. We had the phone record to establish that. The division could not refute that. All the division did was rely on the fact that, gee, we didn't get it. And in September of that year, the division had returned mail come back to them on Mr. Tinklenburg's address, and that's when they supposedly, in the record, discovered that there was a problem with his address. Curiously enough, 1 month earlier is when Naomi Cromwell and Sherry Devers, the investigator, called Mr. Tinklenburg a month before they got this notice, called Mr. Tinklenburg and said, and suggested voluntary revocation of his license. And they talked at that time about an address problem. But they hadn't even been made aware that there was an address problem, which is part of the problem that we had in preparing for the hearing. After repeated requests to provide more specificity to us as to the nature of the charge of failure to give the change of address, it was not until the very day of the hearing that the division finally explained to Mr. Tinklenburg what the problem was. At that time, we moved to dismiss that charge, and hearing examiner Johnson evidently denied that motion because we went on and had testimony on that.
Do you know whether the record shows that Julie Johnson made credibility findings in relation to Tinklenburg's explanation of the change of address?
I don't recall, Your Honor, if there is a specific finding on his credibility.
It's just a general finding of lack of credibility.
correct. I believe that's correct. So we would submit, based on their lack of evidence and the fact that we produced evidence to establish that he did make a phone call in June that lasted a couple of minutes, that they failed to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he violated that statute. With regard to the deposition of Mary Klein and the credibility finding made by the hearing examiner, we would ask the court to consider carefully the record in that the deposition of Mary Klein was taken on her deathbed. In fact, she died pending the criminal proceedings. The record establishes that she was in failing health, that she was weak, and that she was confused. The testimony taken in that deposition is inconsistent with all of the documentary evidence that has been presented in the record to establish that Tinklenburg did help her, did do things for Albert and Mary, whereas she's denying that he did anything for her in her deposition. The other issue is there is no question but that it is her signature on the transfer form. If she didn't want to transfer it to Tinklenburg, she surely could have exercised that right. With regard to the statements that Mary did everything for Albert and to characterize him as an invalid who couldn't do anything for himself, we would urge the court to consider the facts in the record or the evidence in the record that, in fact, Albert ran all of his own business affairs.
What business did he run?
He was a farmer.
So, I mean, he bought the seed and he planted the crops?
Took out loans with the Farmers Home Service Agency.
And what about, why did his sister say that she took care of him all of his life?
Well, I suppose if they lived together, perhaps she did do all the cooking, and perhaps she did, I'm not sure that this is in the record, Your Honor, perhaps she did all the cooking and the cleaning and the washing clothes and that kind of thing. But I think the record is very clear that Albert took care of his own affairs. And it wasn't until 1999 that Mary Ann Brennan, the niece, steps in and starts to handle some of his business affairs. I think it's also noteworthy.
Hadn't he created a power of attorney in somebody prior to the time that he even signed the policy?
No, Your Honor, that is... I don't believe that is.
Who did he create the power of attorney to?
In 1993, Albert was physically incapable of farming anymore. And so he leased his farmland out to a neighbor by the name of Earl Monins. And Earl then managed, physically did the labor on the farm.
Your time has expired. Goes quick.
Thank you.
This is a bittersweet day for us. We're very honored from time to time to have circuit judges sit with us who take the place of the justices disqualified themselves. However, we are well aware that Judge Jean Paul Keene, because he has chosen to retire, this will be his last of many, many trips to visit with the South Dakota Supreme Court. You have rendered distinguished service through many decades as one of our outstanding trial judges, and to paraphrase Ronald Reagan, on an easy day anybody can be a judge, but there are not that many easy days. Judge Keene, I speak for myself, the Supreme Court, and the citizens of the state of South Dakota when I want to thank you for the public service you have faithfully given to this state for many decades, and we wish you and your family a wonderful new career as you move on from your many years of faithful service to the citizens of South Dakota. Thank you.